the Durak field, and then in the process, you'll find, whoa, it's a fermion. And next, so hopefully Wednesday. So next lecture, we'll see the canonical quantization. And you'll be doing what Dan gave you a recipe. And at some point, you'll figure out a Hamiltonian, and you'll stare at it for a while. And then you realize, okay, the only solution for this thing is it's a fermion. So it will be two very completely vastly little different ways to get to the same ending. And I have to emphasize, it's choose one. Okay, if you want to do both, I'm all in for it. But the requirement is to choose one. I need you to tell me that the Dirac field describes in a fermion in some way. At least two ways. You don't have to describe it in all ways. Okay, in today's tutorial, if you ever look at the title, it's called the monster identification, and there will be no calculation whatsoever. It will be completely conceptual. I'm pretty sure there's no calculation whatsoever. I just want you guys to have a huge discussion about the things we have seen, which I refer them as monsters because they haven't been tamed yet. Okay, wait, next line is pumpkin patch. So today, that what I want to achieve is to see some example about how to build a field from scratch, so to speak. So you will see how field emerges only because of quantum mechanics and the special relativity. So it's interesting because the other thing I hope I can achieve plus your home tour, the first version of Homo 2 is to show you a version of spin statistic theorem. I read a Pauli's original paper. I have no idea. So I think this is the version that I can accept as a proof of this very important theorem. So let's build a field. And I do want to say, remember how did we build a field? We have a mysterious thing that is built by the linear combination of these annihilation operators that transform horribly. And hence, that the choice of this linear coefficient has to carry the spin because we're doing a linear combination, has to carry the momentum because we're doing a linear combination. And the only thing different is we introduce this label called a linear, is that we hope this thing transform in Lorentz transformation. And this shouldn't surprise you because you have seen the mode expansion of the scalar field. It looks sort of like this, except it doesn't have that, right? And let's call this ansatz. So instead of what we have worked out last Friday, which is very tough, that's why I decided that interview question is optional, because I don't want my toughest interview questions more than twice as tough as the second one. That wouldn't make the interview fair. But if you choose to tell me the story, I'll be very gladly to hear it. But you are not required to tell the story. Instead, we're gonna say put this thing in a Pandora box to open later when you desire. And there is where the box is. It's almost three pages to show you if we have this ansatz, how to solve for that. Well, let's put it in a box. Somebody has solved it and then claim This is all we need to do. Okay, only open that box when you're ready. Somebody solve it. Says, if you just solve this and I can get this thing at the zero momentum, and I can boost it to get that, and that's the x dependence now shows up as a nonsense. Then we build the field. So, what are we going to do now? Is to pick a rep. This is a rep of Lorentz group. And the next thing we do is to solve this. Believe it or not, solving this is not as hard as the thing in the box where we get this from. And then the next is to assemble our fields. So that's a general recipe if you want to get any field at all. That according to this, because we don't have a field equation, it's not even fundamental. Why would it have an equation? We have this equation says that if you can solve these numbers, because it says a zero momentum, if you can solve these numbers, I know how to get it to be dependent on momentum, throw that in. That's our field. Okay, so we're going to use some first familiar example and then less familiar example to show you how this works. The first example is, what do you think? What is familiar to you? Scalar. So far, it seems this thing is not that very close to our scalar. And then what do we want to do, so to speak? That we need the chicken coming out of the egg, right? When you write it as a mode expansion, that you go from the chicken to egg. Now we just have a bunch of egg, and then we need to know that how the chicken comes. Okay, so here is a question. Why does Dan say scalar is a spin zero boson? I must make this claim at some point.
Didn't hear the question, what did you say?
Why does Dan tell you that the scalar is a spin zero boson?
It takes a trivial representation.
It's in a trivial representation. I accept that answer, but why scalar is a boson? Yeah?
It's invariant under rotations.
Sure. But okay. Let's go from the ending question. Maybe your answer is related. It's just not the one I was thinking about. Maybe later I'll realize it. Okay. What do you need to look at to recognize this particle is a boson?
Energy level.
That equation is the representation of the SU2.
Energy level. That's in some way correct. But it's, I want something more fundamental than the result of the energy level. Yes, Fermi and the boson look different, but yes, someone is saying the right answer. The commutation. Yeah, it's the statistics tell us which is Fermi and which is boson. So, okay, very good. So you have something like this. And then, so why is it a commutator? Why, right? I ask why scalar field is a boson. Then we push it back. Says we need to look at the statistical, we need to look at the commutator or anti-commutator, but why scalar follow the commutator relationship?
It's canonical quantization.
That is the assumption. And that I'm less of a fan of. So what I want to show you is that how the result of this boson also, trivial tells us spin zero, but I want to also tell you that the commutator also coming out of this one assumption, which is we pick the rep. Okay. So let's look at this. Trivial means, I don't know. I'll use the Mathematica way says, it's always one. So like really just one. There's no rep. That's called a trivial. And this one tells us the generators are all zero because generator is the expansion around the one. If it's just like it's strict one, there's nothing to really expand around. So then you look at this right hand side. We pick this to be zero, and then they are just gonna all be zero. Yeah, I pick the rep to be zero. There's nothing on the right. And that says the left hand side has to be zero. And there are two kinds of things. The thing we want had better not be zero. The only thing we can do is to pick this to be zero. And that means this SU2 rep had better be trivial. That tells us J had better be zero. Yeah? It's like a zero, right hand zero, left hand hand zero, then this must be zero. And there's only one way you can eliminate all this rep is putting by picking the spin equals zero. So yes, I agree. The argument. Once you pick the trivial rep, you will see the spin has to be zero. About the commutator, well, I don't quite agree. But this point is everything is zero. I mean, these numbers, well, also, if everything is zero, you're in the trivial representation, so we don't really have a L to indicate how many dimensions it is. Right? It's trivial, so there is no index anymore. We're left, and there's no spin anymore. So let me say this. So we used to have this. And the trivial tells us L is 1. Spin is 0. And spin doesn't have any other opportunity to go up away from 0 because of J. Then we just have a number. This is many numbers. And because we choose the trivial representation, it becomes one number. And this one number, well, we can choose to be one. It can be any number. At this point, we have no reason to believe one is a wrong choice. Maybe later we will. But at this point, I claim I'll just use the proper name, which is a scalar. And all we get is this out of this argument. And this thing hopefully looks familiar. You've seen from the scalar QFT, it's half of your mode expansion. So we're almost there, we're gonna half. Well, of course, I can simply say based on the similar argument, I can get the other half. And we realize even this is nothing but the dagger of the first one. Right? And so want to remind you or actually emphasize, or I didn't emphasize enough in tutorial two, is that in tutorial two, we get this commutator relationship. There is an important detail that I didn't emphasize enough, is that in tutorial two, we did consider both fermions and bosons. We defined our inner product of the states, the norm, to reflect that difference. So in the end, we have this little sign to indicate. So that's Weinberg's notation, which is pretty well. It says if it's a minus sign, then you put a minus sign there. If it's a plus sign, you put a plus sign there. So minus sign means commutator, plus sign means anti-commutator. And I want to remind you is that during that tutorial, remember all these signs you have to assign to the permutation, and all those signs we have to take care of because we want to consider both bosons and fermions. So during that step, we never picked our favorite. We considered both. Which means, so this is what I'm going to do very quickly because you have seen this being done. Except this little thing. See, this is the approach. We're not going to assume scalar is a boson. We are going to just carry this belt, whatever it is, with us. But this is a calculation you must have seen in dance course. Yeah? To take the half of the annihilation part and the creation apart, take a commutator. You've probably seen it in the weak theorem, and probably even before that. So, I can tell you this computation will give you this. Yeah, looks familiar. This thing shouldn't really affect us. Because after we evaluate a commutator, only what's on the right-hand side, it matters. And this is known as the propagator. Yeah, not the Feynman propagator, but a propagator. And it has a very, very important thing, is that it's even one space left. Have you seen this?
No, I've never thought about it. Where do you, is that just from the integral you can tell?
So the idea is this is a four integral, but if it's a space-like, I can choose the time to be the same. So it'll become a three integral. Then you do some trick, like p goes to minus p, and you still have the same integral. And you flipped this, but instead of thinking you flipped the momentum, you can think about it, you flipped the space. It's a common argument we always use is to flip the three momentum to be the negative, to integrate it over, and you will get the same thing. Okay, so what should I do now? Well, what should I do? First thing we should realize from that, I didn't do the calculation. I just told you you have seen this result. Is that, well, your field had better be not annihilation field or creation field because you have this. This is some function, some complicated function would never be zero. That's this. I'm just saying phi minus and a phi plus is not good enough. to build Hamiltonian out. If you just have a bunch of phi plus, phi minus, then there is no way you get this. Says in space, like, then you get zero. You'll be end up with a bunch of those things. So again, it's the same scenario. You have something, and it doesn't behave. It doesn't do what you want. Just like all the other times. What do we do? Remember, the A's doesn't behave. We made a field out of it. Again, linear combination. That's what physics is about. So let's make a linear combination of this thing. Really linear combination. Some numbers in front of it. And now what we want to compute is see if there is any linear combination that will listen to us and give us something that we can use. Okay. In the second line, all I does is to copy the first line down. Okay? Nothing fancy here. I'm just expanding as the linear combination. Okay. Now, okay, very good. Okay, think about it for 2 minutes and tell me which of these terms contribute. Okay? In principle, there are four terms, but I claim that not all four terms contribute. Right? What we're looking at is phi minus phi minus, phi minus phi plus phi minus, and the phi plus phi plus. Right? So what will contribute?
Minus phi plus. Minus, the minus doesn't because it's AA.
Yeah, see, phi minus, they have AA. So, and plus plus will have A dagger. So only thing left here is when you pair them up with K lambda, phi minus, phi plus, and you can pair them up again, which is K lambda, phi plus, phi minus. So this is very good. This is exactly what we just talked about. This is some propagator we know. This is slightly not good because our propagator is defined to be minus plus, and this is plus minus. So what would happen? How do I write this also using a propagator?
Even, I guess. No.
Help. So remember, like, let's do it by step. If it's a commutator, what happens if I want to switch them? You get a minus sign. And what happens if it's a plus? It doesn't care, right? Because it's an anti-commutator. And because now the y comes in first, and it becomes this. Do you all agree? I need to switch this, and consider the minus, and then consider the plus. Okay, so we know this is even. So I can sort of take it out. So all I have is this. At the space line.
Space-like?
Because we only care about a space-like for the Hamiltonian to be commute. If it's time-like, and then it doesn't matter because it's time order. It would never have a chance to be not time. Okay. Well, remember, we want this to be ideally zero to match with the special relativity requirement, so-called the causality. So, what can we do to make this expression zero?
Choose the minus sign.
Choose the minus sign. And here that I show you that it is a boson. Because special relativity requires it to be a boson. So say this is my first example of a spin statistics theorem. You choose a rep, now the rep will tell us the spin. The rep simultaneously also tell us it better be a boson. So we somehow manage to link the spin equals zero coming from a rep of group theory and the conclusion of it's a boson without assuming anything else, but you pick a rep. Well, we have to pick a rep. So.
But what about some ones, like, they should also respect positivity?
What?
Should also...
Yeah, that's the next part, right? That's the next part of the next part of the lecture. I just want to conclude that actually you can do some extra work, but the less important result than this, to show you that you can pick this. And then once you pick this, you get your scalar field. This you have to look in the notes. But once you get a scalar field, it's guaranteed to satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation. The equation actually comes at the end. Okay, so the egg has hatched, and then we got our first chicken. And I think it'll be good if we take a break. A little early break, okay?
What if we consider to construct a chemical?
You want to build something like this?
Is it an assumption or like is there any rule you have to consider?
I have to think about it. At this point,
you always have two annihilators together. You won't guess. You always have two annihilators like coming in pairs. You will not have like odd number of annihilators. I think you
know. I don't have answer because the zeros order is that it worked, but that's not a very good answer. I'll think about it. I'll just try to do something like this and say what happened.
But the big picture was that that commutator doesn't vanish. That's why we need to make another field which is a linear combination of those two.
Exactly. That's the big picture. Because if you have this and then write your Hamiltonian at something like this, and because of this, but then you kind of control if this is going to actually give you this all the time. Maybe you get very lucky, but then remember, like our starting point is how to actually write down the interaction systematic, not to write down this, and they transform horribly, and you scratch your head really hard trying to write down something match with it. So in order to write down something you can systematically, to write down, such that this work, the easiest way is to make your field already, at the field level already commit. And of course, if you think about the Hamiltonian, I mean, this thing probably exists, right? Because if you look at this and write each of them as phi plus phi minus, I mean, one sum of the term will look like this. But then it's harder to control what you put in from. Like, basically, this term wouldn't be enough. You would have to have all the terms. So yes, you can write a term like this, but then you have to write a bunch of terms to go with it because you realize, okay, it's not commute, and I have to fix it. And then eventually you probably end up with the expansion of this.
But the actual commutator that we want to vanish, it's something that is like observable, so it's Hamiltonian.
Exactly, not font field, because we'll see the example, like the example, like throughout the part two, is that the Dirac field does not commute because it's not an observable.
So it's not a fundamental argument.
It's not
a statistic that we need the fields to like. If fields are space like separated, the commutator should be zero. It's not a fundamental argument.
No. See, you really don't want to say this, right? If you say this, this tells you it's probably. It bows on that, and then we're in big trouble. So it's kind of I can give you a short version. It's something we will gradually figure out. Probably by next Monday, you will hear the long version. But the shorter version is what Tom says is that Psi, if it's observable, but he says, well, you don't have any lab equipment that they rotate and pick up a minus line, that doesn't happen. So the short answer is that this will never, it's not good enough to build our Lagrangian waves. What we needed is a pair of them. And you say a pair of fermions sort of a behavior like a boson. We can make that argument more sharp. But the point is you can never build Hamiltonian with all the number.
I didn't get it.
If you have Psi, which is the Dirac field, and you have three of them, you already know this cannot, it's not acceptable. I'll tell you the long version next month when we start to build the interactions.
How did you choose K and lambda to be one?
In the notes. It doesn't, it only gave you the K and the lambda equals one can be chosen one. It's not as a, you know, beautiful physics conclusion like that. So I'm not going to show you on the board.
It's somehow related to the GS question. That means that the statistic that we're going to use, it depends on the Hamiltonian, right? Like we need the commutator of Hamiltonians to be zero. So like we need to define fields in a way that they
yes.
Remove the Hamiltonian. So as many as it depends on Hamiltonian all the time.
No, it depends on this. It depends on this. But this is what a special relativity hands us. It doesn't need a field.
So maybe that doesn't correspond to a field that is like a linear.
It doesn't.
Like maybe some.
Okay, I'll work it. No, I'll work that out. Okay. I'm already tell you I'm doing it after the class, so you can't get an answer out of me because I don't know the answer. Okay. So this example is very, very appealing to look at. Hence, we're going to do another example which spices things up. I'll drop the zero because it means it's a number. That's all I need. Okay. So that example is very cute. And it tells us, yes, if you build from scratch, the only thing you assume is special relativity and a quantum mechanics, and not mention field at all, you will end up with a field after you choose a wrap. So this time we'll pick the spinner wrap, Remember you said in tutorial 3? I don't expect you to remember the result, but this is the result. Okay? Remember the spinner wrap, and you get some rotation, and at least you know that in the third opponent it looks like that. And if you do everything, you realize, okay, everything together, it's like that. And a very interesting thing you notice is this is block diagonal. So that inspires Weinberg to choose a different notation. Says, so L, this index L, is supposed to tell us which wrap we are in, which is in a spinner wrap. But he says, I can split it into this, which plus means the upper block, and minus means the lower block. Yeah? And M is the 2x2 within each poly. nothing really stops him from choosing this weird notation. He says, I'm splitting L, which you can count. It's 1, 2, 3, 4. There's 4 of them. I'm choosing it to be upper and lower, and each of them has 2. Yeah? It's very weird. But this notation works. And he says, we are going to change that equation. I'll try not to just write on top of that equation. So mostly I'm writing things identical, except using this weird notation, and then something else dramatic happened. You can see, not much happening here, not much happening here. I turned L prime into this weird notation, this L into this notation. What really happens is in the middle. He says, since it's block diagonal, then I can split also block diagonal and identical. So I can split this one equation into the equation corresponding to the upper block, which is plus, and another equation corresponding to the lower block. And whatever this J is split into 2 blocks, and each of the block is 1/2 sigma. Yeah? And you're like, what this is going to give me, right? The next thing he does is also very interesting. He says, these are just a bunch of index. I can move them around and call this guy a matrix. Yeah? Plus, minus is telling me upper, lower block. But then it has 2 index. He will turn it into a matrix, not doing anything here yet. And well, this is already a matrix. It's the Stableman matrix. But he will say, I'll do this too. You have 3 index. You can move it however you want, because once you write out all the index, they are just a bunch of numbers.
Is it a 2x1 matrix?
Huh? 2 plus 1?
2 cross 1, I mean.
What do you mean?
Why is it a matrix?
The only thing he says is I have 3 index. Once you write out every single index out, it's basically a number. But nobody stops him to write these index this way. You can write your index in whichever order you want. But he says, if I do this, I can see, wow, this is summed over. this is also summed over, so now it becomes a matrix equation. Yep.
But the dimension of the matrix depends on the dimension of the representation.
Of course, at this point, yes. That's a very good question. We have, well, we know the spinner is four dimension because we can, this is the representation we choose. So we know M is two dimension, but we have no idea about the S. So we have some idea about the dimension of this matrix, but not all. But he says, wow, it's a matrix. Let me just write it out as a matrix equation. So drop all the index such that it actually looks like matrix equation. So this line compared to this line, just erase all index because now it's clear. The matrix multiplication. Yeah. And you're like, where is he going with this? Now he's going to say something important. He says, well, this is Pauli. So this is a wrap of SU2. And remember this side, it's always has been a rep of SU2 because this comes from the little group. All the way originally, it comes from the little group. And then there is this Schur's lemma. I don't know how to prove Schur's lemma. There is some proof on the Wikipedia. But Schur's lemma tells us if such U exist and they're related to rep of the same group, then there's only two things U can be. First is zero, which doesn't help. Okay, the second is it has to be a square matrix. A mathematician claims you are relating two rep of the same group. Then I have to something to say about it. But clearly we're not picking the zero. We're always looking for something. That something cannot be zero. So we are forced to choose a square matrix. And now if you go back, that tells that S range of S had a better be 2. I can even choose it to be half, minus half. That's the only way that you can make U a square matrix. Any other rep would be bigger or smaller and become 0. And that's one. You have the hard conclusion that if you want to build a spinner representation, you have no choice but end up with a spin half particle. So you can do more examples, which there are examples in his book. But this is what is it about? Is that from that very weird equation, if you pick a rep and you solve it and you use Schur's lemma, you get a spin. Yep.
What is the connection of this formulation of Schur's lemma with the commutator version of it? Do you know?
No. I don't know anything about the Schur's. Sorry. I can try to learn about it. But I only know Schur's lemma whenever it's used. But I can try to learn about the Schur's lemma and then you talk to me afterwards. Okay? Yeah. So
the restriction is that J should be a square matrix.
Exactly.
So range of S should be
U has to be a square. U has to be a square matrix. Well, it's the thing that link to rep has to be square matrix. Like if you know one rep, another rep, and you somehow have some matrix link them that way, then they have to be square matrix. So, wow, right? Spring half just come out to us that like that. And then now that we know it's a spin half, the easiest way to choose, okay, the easiest, so if this is a spin half, what's the rep we know? That's the easiest. Spin half, two-dimensional rep. And it's poly. So now you get this. Do you know any matrix commute with all the three poly matrices? Identity. So what this argument show you, this is the identity. And if you go back to this weird notation, it tells you you must have this thing here, which tells the identity. But then, of course, you have the upper half, lower half, they're separate equations. Who knows what they are, right? So let me write this in a better way. What it's saying is that this four-dimensional spinner must look like this. This is 1/2, minus 1/2, 1/2, minus 1/2. And if it's spin 1/2, then only the top and the top can be non-zero, determined by this. So this is making some huge advantage on this four-dimensional spinner thing. We know nothing before. Now we kill the two components. And you can do it, of course, for the U minus 1/2 if you have spin down. So what I'm gonna do is not to show you further about how to relate them. But it turns out parity is gonna help us, which is on page 78. Okay, if you read through page 78, parity tells us this can be further solved. And the idea why we should use parity is, of course, that in QED, for example, parity is a symmetry. And if anywhere Dirac field plus test beta has that symmetry, you'd better build something respect that symmetry. Because having a symmetry, and later you don't want it to break it, that's it. If you have no symmetry at all and somehow you want the symmetry to jump out at you, that's a lot harder. So that's why it's a good assumption that we should assume this and that what it gave us. And the idea is that the main idea of the argument is this under parity. So let me write it. So this is xt and become minus xt, and it should be proportional. Then you realize this is really hard to do. Then you say it's proportional by constant matrix, which makes sense because these things we know they are four dimensional. L goes to from 1, 2, 3, 4. And what it tells us if you look at it, So this, okay, I forgot to mention this thing. This BU is not something arbitrary. It can only take plus or minus. It's very constrained. You have almost solved what's this. And basically what a parity tells you is somehow it relates the upper half and the lower half of the Dirac field. That we'll do next month. Okay. And the question is now, of course you ask, is this Dirac field that we build? I haven't write on the Dirac field, but the Dirac field is like that, and then you change the chi into a psi. It's exactly that. And you're like, this, it's called the annihilation field for the B particle. People normally use new letters for spinner to be separated from scalar. But basically, you are almost done. You get all these U of zero and boosted, plug in there. You're like, oh, I build you a Dirac field. So, but then, what do you think the harder question is? I show you the spins 1/2. I promised you. That's much harder. But what did I show you in scalar case? I show you the spin zero, and it's a boson. So what do you think the harder work is to show that is a fermion, right? And that is your first version of second homework. To encourage you to do it, I wrote a song. But this song is much harder to sing than the other one. Much harder. Well, the only good news is only 30 seconds, so I wouldn't suffer too much from it. Do you wanna build a Dirac field? Come on, let's go and play. I invite you to give a try. Pull out the paper, it's like playing Lego. Field used to be fundamental, and now it's not. I wish you would tell me why. Do you wanna build a Dirac field? And the sheet of music I called like the free sheet of music ends after that, so I have no idea what's going on afterwards. Okay, so, and with that we almost conclude the first part. So now we transition to the second part of the normal canonical quantization. And as you can see, that almost all the interview questions are about the second part. You know that where my emphasis is, okay? So I do want you to be familiar with the group theory, especially as you do. But what happened in between, it's optional. But I do hope you know do this. Well, this homework, I would say, I wouldn't recommend it if this is the first time you ever seen Dirac field. But if you have already seen Dirac field once, and you really want to know this mathematical foundation of UFT, where it from, how do I actually build a Dirac field from scratch, I want you to look into it, okay? But based on your own background, make your own choice. And the second version of homework I think we'll get to it on Wednesday. Yeah. So now let's see. So I said I made a transition from the inverse QFT to the QFT. And I remind you, we have states, and these states are given by SU2. And then we see a dagger, which come out of a tutorial 2. And then, of course, if you introduce a dagger, you have to introduce the commutator. And then we build a field. And this is the chicken. And then we have field equations. And now, so what do you think it'll be like? Really savory. It will be really nice. What do you think? What does Dan does in his QPFD? You start with a field equation. You go to field. And you define some Lagrangian Hamiltonian, but the purpose of those things is to get a commutator. And then you define the states at the end. Yeah, it's really QFT and the inverse QFT. And then they form a loop.
What's underneath SU2? What does that say?
Oh, I'm just saying, oh, this one. This one says tutorial 2.
What is the one beneath that?
I'm just seeing the, it's a chicken. And this is the egg. And you can see it's really like a chicken and egg. It goes in circles. I mean, at this point, what do you call it a fundamental, right? It's a full circle.
Are any of them like actually fundamental, or we just have no idea and neither?
I don't think we have any idea. If you like experiments, you would say the states are more fundamental. That's what I collide in my collider, right? That's why, just from the beginning, says field is fundamental, and well, it's very, it gives a bad taste because you're telling me all these things, but I'm doing experiment with the states, with the particles. But on the other hand, I don't know. I think that's a question you probably want to ask Rob Speckens or Louis, Lucien. I think they have a better question, better answer about which is fundamental, which is not. And I am very applied, and do not. That's the philosophical question we ask, and I don't know any philosopher gives the correct answer. I also think that the philosophy doesn't really have a correct answer. So here, so from now on, you will be hearing a bunch of dialogues between me and a curious student. That let's just say that person is Dan. Okay. Dan says, Dan sometimes is actually very childish. So Dan would be saying, oh, I want to play the game. And I'll be, sure, let's start. And you go, and Dan says, okay, I pick electron, and it's going to travel from, wait, do you know how electron propagates? No, but I have learned from QFT. Quantum theory that the propagator is the inverse of the differential operator in the equation of motion. Do you know the equation of motion of an electron? Huh? That was also what Dirac was worried about almost 100 years ago. So let's travel back in time and see. So as I said, now I'm really formally switched to part two. And it is given many years without part one because I didn't have part one. So that's also how it would be given like that. I would not depend on anything about the part one. So you can assume they didn't happen, except the tutorial. I still need the tutorial 3, the spinner rep. So otherwise, I really don't think I need anything. And of course, I would need today's tutorial. Okay. So our starting point is Klein-Gordon equation. So nothing I say from now will depend on the first part, except, you know, if it go into your head and says, wow, it's really a loop, that'd be nice. Okay, I'm just going to write this down as my starting point. Okay? Yeah, that's fine. Klein and Gordon equation, good starting point. Good. And the next thing is Dirac's motivation. look, Dirac's coming from a pretty shitty motivation to the most famous equation ever. So it's ridiculous. So don't be to pay too much attention to what his motivation, because his motivation is not even true. So the point is, Dirac, if you have seen the Noether theorem video I sent you, it's okay if you didn't. And if you do the quiz, okay, it didn't, you have to just trust me. What Dirac says is, I can calculate the Noether current of a complex scalar field, and I can compute the conserved current, and hence find out the density, which is normally, you know, the zeros component of the current, which is what he identified with probability density. And Dirac's whole motivation is that the probability density is negative. So his motivation is, no, the probability density can't be negative. I want it to be positive. And if you do the quiz, you will realize that I have given you a very specific example, and I ask you to calculate what's the probability density, and it is negative. So then, well, okay, it's not a completely bad motivation, except that later this density has been basically interpreted as the number density, and the antiparticle is given a minus one for counting. So you are counting like particle minus antiparticle. So that minus negative density, totally acceptable. But Dirac is like, no, this is totally unacceptable, and the Klein-Gordon equation must have something wrong, and I need to fix it. So throughout his calculation about this Noether current, he realized that the Noether current is going to have one time derivative in the probability density. And he says, no, that's the problem. If I have a zero, I'll be all good. And his claim is it's a second order differential equation. So you go through the Noether thing, you'll get a time derivative left. If you get it with only a first order derivative, then the time derivative would disappear. And he's right. You put it in the Noether theorem, and then if you have a only first order equation, his problem is solved. So that's his motivation. And all his motivation tells him, I want one time derivative in equation of motion. My equation can only have one time derivative. So what's the immediate thing that squeezes you out?
Take a square root.
That's not what Dirac do. That's what I'm going to do. But Dirac is like some more. Well, but what he does is somewhat complicated. A little. Okay, but that was very far away. So let's just stare at a one-time derivative. Dirac wants to write down a special relativity compatible quantum mechanics. Special relativity quantum mechanics. But that's one time derivative to tell you.
What's
the derivative? You also have to have a one space derivative. Otherwise, special relativity will scream at you that they are not put at equal footing. Okay, now the next step is that he realized that he could take a square root, so-called square root. It's okay. So Dirac, well, he wrote down his equation and nobody argued with him, so that's the thing we're gonna do. He says, to take a square root of this thing, I'm gonna write down as a square plus b square. Sort of okay. A is partial mu, b is m. And he says, how do I factorize it? Well, clearly you can factorize it. And somehow, the thing A picked, well, it's not, I told you, the square root is the what people do after him finding the equation, and find the easier way to explain. He did something else. But anyway, in order to match with Dirac's Dirac equation, that's how we're going to factorize it. So it's like a complex number. You're probably more familiar with a plus ib, a minus ib. And this is nothing but a slightly weirder version. So you'll be like, cool. Yes, cool. I'm going to now go back to a, which is partial mu, to b, which is m, and here we go. He says this is how you factorize it. And since I'm taking the square root, I'm only taking one half. And he chooses the best letter in the Greek alphabet, right? Because they also represent a group of young, talented people who are devoted to theoretical physics.
Why is that the square root?
It's not a square root. That's why this is a very weird way to say it. It's not a square root. It's really more like taking a square root of a comp. It's more like taking a square root of this thing, but it's actually a start, and you want to get only this. So it's not a square root. But see, this is not what Dirac is varying. Dirac says, I'll just cut half and claim that this equals zero. And what's the biggest problem in this equation? Huh? Here's a mu there. That's not good. We should always match our indexes. That's where the gamma matrix come from. They are the linear coefficients in that partial derivative such that the index is canceled. Yeah?
The motivation for having one-time derivative was that energy density should be positive?
The number, yeah, well, number density. No, the probability density.
So it's not positive in Klein-Gödel equation?
No. You can do the quiz, and I give an example that is connected.
Klein-Gödel is also a true relation which bosons follow.
That's right. But for example, can you just do the quiz? I give you a quiz, then you need to do the quiz, and then find out what's the density, and then you realize the density is indeed negative.
It should not be.
It's antiparticle. Antiparticle can be negative.
Why is it a problem?
It's not a problem. I told you that he has a shitty motivation. He didn't realize there was another explanation of that problem. He was like, no, this is a problem. I need to fix it. And that's how the renowned Dirac equation come to play, is because he didn't find the alternative explanation of a problem he finds, but he really insists to solve his problem.
But there are antiparticles of fermions as well. So why is the energy density not negative?
Can you wait until they show up? When they show up, you would realize if you calculated the Noether theorem, which you need to read the video and do the quiz and do it for Dirac, this is what I'm going to say. This is indeed positive definite. Until you make the quantization and you switch some things, then maybe things different. Like only after normal ordering, you get to the antiparticle. But the normal ordering in fermion is very different from normal ordering in boson. One is a commutator, one is anti-commutator. You get different things. Okay, yes.
I think your motivation behind saying that your Dirac equation should be first order derivative was that the, you didn't want a probability density that could be negative, right?
That's right.
But
that's his motivation.
Okay. His motivation. But why wouldn't one say, okay, I want the third order derivative or fifth order, whatever? Why first order?
It's easier than second. If there's zero answer, it's even the best. That's the algebra. You probably will get to the third if you consider spring half, three half. No?
Yes,
I don't know. I don't know about spring. Okay, so that's his motivation, and he writes this down. Do you know what's the first thing that we need to check?
This should satisfy Klein-Gordon.
Yeah, it is still need to satisfy Klein-Gordon equation because that one basically tells us p squared equals m squared. The Dirac doesn't like this equation, but he can't argue with that. Maybe he did.
I think the main motivation of Dirac also comes from that p squared equal to n squared. It's like we can have negative energy, maybe like if we.
Oh, Dirac has a better story. I can tell you at the end of the class about the
negative energy for.
Because in the Klein-Gordon equation, it's a second order. Like yeah, Dirac also can have.
Oh.
But
sure. I can tell you that story that Dirac says. That's the famous Dirac C. Dirac says, because I'm studying fermions, so I'm just going to fill up all the negative energies. Like, here's a energy level. View. These are the negative things. It's all filled out by the fermions. Possible, because the exclusion principle, if it fills up, I will never to be seeing an active one. And then he says, oh, this part is very good. He says, what if there is a hole here? And this one is, of course, the electron. But what a completely filled C with a hole is. And then he studied, well, it has the negative charge of the electron, so that must be a positron or anti-electron. Well, he actually, you know, tortured himself a little bit about what if it's proton stuff. But then he eventually, with other people's contribution, he realized it got to be the antiparticle. And this is the best part of the history. He says it should be an antiparticle. And Anderson find it in the lab next year.
Oh, yeah.
Oh wow, it's either 1 year or 3 years, but it's like really ridiculous quick. He says, look for this thing. It just looks like an electron, except it has the other charge. And by then, you know, they're cloud chamber. It's very easy to find. It's either this way or that way. Yeah, it's the identical trajectory, except the other way. So it's, and then yeah, see, it's this equation is way too smart.
Do we know at this moment what the nature of gamma is? Or you just put
We are going to say right now. Right now, at this instant. One more line, but right now. See this thing, right? This thing is the Klein and Gordon equation. It's this full expansion, so he added it back. So I'd better get a Klein and Gordon equation. So of course, he expanded this thing. And then he says, this thing had a better agree with my Klein-Gordon operator. And the only, so what needs to happen? I have partial nu, and I have partial nu, partial nu. What would this be? It would be so nice that it would become that. It has to be eta mu nu, right? But then you realize, wait, but this is symmetric. And this, why would it be symmetric? It can't be symmetric. So what he does is to take a symmetric part of it. I'm sure you're very familiar with this technique after Homer 1. right? That's the same technique. And if you move the two on the other side, then you should recognize that is the very weird algebra I gave you in tutorial 3. Instead of say, mathematician has this insight, Dirac says, no, no, no. Physically, this has to be true. And of course, this is known as the Dirac matrix. And we know the other part of story from tutorial 3, like what kind of gamma can we pick? Okay, the thing I want to emphasize is gamma is a bunch of numbers. Well, at least when Dirac wrote it down, he wanted nothing but a bunch of linear coefficients. And the further along we know, it is satisfy some algebra. Well, that means they are generators of some algebra, but which means they are a bunch of numbers. The rep of the generators will only give you numbers. They are numbers. You can try to discuss that, maybe you can generalize it, but as far as Dirac pointed out, they are a bunch of numbers, and they're numbers. And I'm just trying to tell you something about the tutorial you know. Is that I have nothing to say about it either. They're really just numbers, but on the other side, because they are rep, if they're rep, you can do some weird thing like the similar matrices, similar transformation, and turn into some other number. Then you are in a different rep. That's fine. They're intrinsically numbers, and there are four of them, and so to be very honest, I should write this. Well, I explained a little bit of why 2 by 2 is not going to work. And if all the dimensions do not work, so we are moving to the lowest dimension, which is dimension 4. And that's what Dirac wants. Dirac wants linear coefficients, like a 2, 3, 4, 5, not a 5x. That's what he wants. But once you get to this step, and you can consult with your mathematician, they say, "Wow, this is algebra."
But why did Dirac want that?
I'm not Dirac. It'll be great if I'm Dirac, but I'm not. I would assume that he wants them to be numbers because numbers are easier than functions.
Okay.
As physicists, we always try to do simple problems, and then I guess after he discovered this, and he never go back to say, oh, what if they are functions? Well, maybe he did ask that question, and he has a side note. Blah, 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 that's why we should consider function. But, private note that I had never have no access.
Okay.
Okay, I know I think this is great. I'm just going to stop here.